My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
The Iraq war is estimated to have cost taxpayers trillions of dollars, and the bills haven't stopped yet. Tens of thousands of soldiers and Marines were wounded in combat, and more than 4,000 were killed. Among the casualties was Sergeant Sherwood Baker, who died on April 26, 2004. His mother, Celeste Sapala, joins us on Radio Times. She's an active member of Military Families Speak Out, a founding member of Gold Star Families Speak Out. And Celeste Sapala, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Marty, thank you for having me. I appreciate being with you.
You know, you have talked with us several times over the last 10 years about what happened to your son and about the war in Iraq. Does it feel any different today as we, in a sense, mark the 10th anniversary of the start of the Iraq war?
Well, it does and it doesn't. I feel much older than I did in the beginning of all this. And I still miss Sherwood every day, and the loss of his life is still profound in the lives of his family and the in his community where he lived. That doesn't change, and you know, the fact that we've come these 10 years and everything that we said going into the war has basically been proven to be true, but there's no real victory in that. Being right about something that proves to be a terrible mistake, there is little comfort in it.
How is his family doing?
Well, his son is 18 now. Wow. He was 9 when his dad was killed. He is graduating from high school this year. His mom has remarried, and they are okay. They've come through. I know that his son misses him every day, has created a little room in the house with all of his medals and uniforms and the flags given. We will never know how his son's life would have been had Sherwood lived. And that's always the question. What would life have been for everyone had Sherwood survived or never been put in that position in the first place?
Your son, sure.
And for the rest of us, it's been hard. You know, it's,
sure.
It's not as if a soldier is killed and there's a wonderful ceremony and then everything is all right. You know, the effects of that loss go on in your life forever.
You mentioned the fact that you feel older. I mean, you are older, but older in a different kind of way.
Yeah, I guess just for the effort that was expended for the loss of hope that you have in a child, for the roads that we've walked in these past 10 years. We've, as you know, have been active with a lot of really fine people who also were trying to cast a light on the insanity of the war and to try to bring an end to it more quickly. And it does take a toll. It really does take a toll. I'm glad that we were able to be as vocal as we were and try to convince people. And I always hope that has an effect on the people that we spoke with and the protests that we held, the things we wrote. I always hope that has an effect, but certainly there's an emotional and physical cost that wears you down after a while.
Your son, Sergeant Sherwood Baker, was actually part of a team of people whose job it was to protect the Iraq survey group,
that's right,
looking for these weapons of mass destruction. And he was killed more than a year after the war actually started. And I remember you talking with us about the particularly, I guess, painful part of his death?
Yes, he was guarding that unit on April 26th in 2004, and it was long after everyone was pretty certain that the weapons weren't there, and David Key had already resigned from the ISG, and everyone, you know, was fairly certain, but they were still looking, I guess, to prove that they weren't there. And he was in a Humvee. There was an explosion in a what proved to possibly be a chemical factory, and debris flew through the air, and as he got out of his Humvee to try to help others who were hurt, he was hit and died shortly thereafter.
Mm.
And we had spoken 2 days before. He used to call quite a bit from Iraq, and he would always say, don't worry, I'm going to be okay, I'm going to do my job and come home. And he was part of the National Guard, which one in those days before Iraq, the National Guard stayed here and didn't go into wars. And he would always say to us, don't worry, no one in the Pennsylvania Guard has been killed since 1945. Don't worry. And of course, he became the first Pennsylvania Guardsman to be killed in that war, and since the Second World War. And it was an excruciating time. We learned that evening that he had been killed. I had actually heard something on the radio that day about two people being killed in Iraq, and I just prayed that it wasn't him. And then time passed during the day, and I knew it took 8 hours before you could be notified. And when the 8 hours passed, I thought, well, it's okay, we're all right. But we weren't. And an Army officer appeared on my porch that evening to tell me that Sherwood had been killed.
And did you assume that once you saw him, he was going to tell you this terrible truth?
Yeah, I opened the door and I saw him on the porch, and I just started screaming. I knew what that would mean, and I kept saying, was he killed in the factory? Was he killed in the factory? I could tell, you know, later I could understand that this man had come to me. It was very, very uncomfortable and probably terrified of what the news was that he had to tell me. And it was just the worst moment of my life to see him standing on my porch and to understand what that message was going to be.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Then having to tell my other sons and to go and visit with Sher's wife and son, and you know, just try to get ourselves through that time. And I, as you know, Marty, we made a decision right away that we were going to speak what we saw as the truth, that the war was wrong. And it was a position that many people criticized us for at that time, but we just felt that we couldn't be quiet. In order to honor Sherwood's life, we had to speak the truth about the war and the fact that it should never have happened.
In fact, you were a founding member of Gold Star Families Speak Out. You're now an active member of Military Families Speak Out. Since the war is, I guess, officially over, although, as we know, there are many casualties stateside of veterans dealing with some of the physical and psychological wounds of the war, what does Family Members Speak Out about?
Well, it's an organization that tries to support military families who have either passed through the war and are now veteran families, or people still with active duty families, and to try to support those who have been opposed to the war. And and you know, we're left with so many casualties. There are probably 40,000 people who were wounded in the war, who face a lifelong recovery. You know, people without limbs, without eyes. There are people who continue to suffer with PTSD. There are suicides at the most awful rate. You know, we again the I think too many people would wish to think that once the war is over, it's over. But it goes on in the lives of the people who are affected. And the price to be paid in their humanity will go on forever, for as long as they're alive. They carry great burdens, and we mustn't forget that, and we mustn't forget the Iraqis whose country we destroyed and whose lives are never going to be all right. And when I listened to the pundits all week long talking about the war, and some of them were saying, well, maybe it was really okay, and maybe we learned a good lesson, you know, I wish that people could remember that there were hundreds of thousands of people around the world who protested the war before it started, who spoke out against it while it was going on, and it was the pundits and the politicians who refused to listen to the people's voices. And I hope that we won't ignore the voices of the Iraq veterans now, who, as they try to put their lives back together, need the country's support, and we have a great debt to them to pay.
In fact,
to help the families.
In fact, we have someone later in the show to talk particularly and specifically about that. But what do you think, Celeste, is what are the lessons of this war? We have about a minute and a half before we have to say goodbye.
Well, I think that the first lesson is that we should question politicians who are anxious to go to war and question their motives and their facts, and that that we should take our citizenship very, very seriously and not be lulled into thinking that the experts know more than we do in our own gut. I think that it's imperative that we think about ourselves in the world as not just, you know, the so-called policemen, but we have other responsibilities using our intelligence and our wealth towards trying to create more equality in the world, which would lessen the conflicts that occur, and that we have to search for ways to create peace between peoples and nations, rather than assuming that our military capacity is going to protect us from the conflicts that boil all around us and the inequality that boils around us. We have responsibilities in the world as citizens, and they are not just to support a giant military. They are to try to find reasonable ways for people to accommodate each other, to get along with each other. And I would hope, as, you know, sometimes as tired and angry as I feel, I keep thinking of what Martin Luther King said, you know, I'll stick with love. Hate is too great a burden to bear. And that's what we have to do. We have to stick with love.
Well, on that note, as always, Celeste Apollo, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Marty, thank you. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. And she's an active member of Military Families Speak Out. Coming up next, we'll be calling into Iraq to find out what life is like in that country. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY, an affiliate of the Penn Cancer Network, offering access to complex treatment options, clinical trials, a multidisciplinary team approach, and helpful nurse navigators. ChesterCountyHospital.org.
Next time in Studio 360, if we're now living in the golden age of television, who's the king? Hard to say, but Edie Falco would definitely be queen.
Mr. Zubenko, my name is Jackie. Is it okay if I talk to you for a minute? It looks like you had a stroke.
From Carmela Soprano to Nurse Jackie, the great Edie Falco. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
How long have we been hearing that breastfeeding is best, both for mom and child, but how long have we known that it still isn't easy?
Babies pretty much are born equipped to do it, but mothers have to learn how to do it.
We'll talk about efforts to support breastfeeding, where they are succeeding and where they are falling short. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowane. Today in Baghdad, more than 50 people were killed by a series of bombings with more than 200 wounded. This comes 10 years after the U.S.-led invasion, which led to the displacement of more than a million Iraqis. Some fled to neighboring countries, while others were forced to look for shelter and safe haven inside of Iraq. Where are those refugees today? Joining us is Laura Jacoby. She's Iraq Country Director for the International Rescue Committee, and she's been overseeing all of the committee's humanitarian programming in country. And Laura Jacoby, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
You are in Baghdad, and at least the news out of that city this morning is that there have been a series of bombings in Baghdad. How common is that?
Today's bombings, that they were more than we usually have, but it's actually been fairly regular. It's a pretty regular occurrence to have car bombs going off in Baghdad.
Does that tell us that there's kind of a low-grade civil war sectarian conflict in Iraq today?
Well, low-grade, yes. The reasons behind the kind of attacks, they vary. They're not necessarily sectarian, I guess. They're often targeted towards the government, but we haven't regularly seen sectarian violence against the Sunni and the Shia against each other. I wouldn't necessarily call it sectarian violence, I guess is what I would say.
No, I hear you and I appreciate that. Going back, I guess since the start of the Iraq war, which was 10 years ago, how many refugees did that war create? How many Iraqi refugees?
Well, so they figure over 2 million Iraqis were actually displaced. It was probably well over. A lot of them were not registered, but a lot of Iraqis, of course, went to Syria and Jordan and Lebanon, and then other countries. But the numbers that were displaced inside of Iraq was over a million in and of itself. And those are we call them internally displaced persons. So they never left the country, so they weren't actually refugees, but they were displaced inside Iraq. They had to move from, and a lot of them were just displaced, within Baghdad. So they went from their neighborhood in Baghdad, which was predominantly, there were a lot of mixed neighborhoods in Baghdad, actually. So they would go from their mixed neighborhood where they no longer felt safe to a neighborhood that was predominantly, their sex and where they felt safer. And that's where many of them have stayed. A lot of them have not felt safe enough to return to their area of origin.
So where are they living? How are they living if they're not back in their communities or not back in their homes or apartments?
Right. So a lot of them, found a house to rent in their new neighborhood. There was a lot of switching. So people would go, they'd have to leave their houses and they'd go to another neighborhood. And so then the people coming into that neighborhood would kind of squat or live in that house. Or the lucky ones were able to sell their houses. Actually, my colleague just told me today he's just now able to sell his house in his original neighborhood where he grew up, but where he cannot go back to right today. And it's just across town. But he's just now able to sell that so that he can buy a new house in a new neighborhood. But he's been renting, and he's actually one of the luckier ones because he's employed and he has the means to rent. Now a lot of them, when they left their homes or were forced to leave their homes, a lot of them couldn't sell their homes, and they ended up again squatting in government-owned lands or abandoned buildings, and they have. Over the 10 years, just built kind of makeshift homes for themselves. But it's very tenuous where they are because they're not really there legally.
Sure.
And in fact, what we're seeing now, as there's continued development in Baghdad, we're seeing these people being evicted from these tenuous situations. And they really have no place to go. So a lot of these, they call them settlements. And a lot of these settlements, there were never any kind of official, you know, real services delivered, because they were never meant to be permanent. So the living conditions are often very poor, with no, you know, no septic, no water. And then that's a lot of, about 150,000 are still living like that in Baghdad. And then even that, they are losing even that place to live. And what we're seeing is the ones that have been evicted are going to another informal settlement that where they're even worse off. But if the eviction is happening illegally, they have to leave everything. They don't get compensated for what they were able to build up over the years that they were there. So we actually, that's part of what we do is we've created a early warning system for evictions. And so, our lawyers can go in and at least make sure that there's some compensation and, you know, there are some laws around how these people are supposed to be evicted. So we're trying to make sure that those are respected.
Well, Lord, is the government capable or able to help these people who are displaced inside of Iraq?
Yeah, well, so the government has developed, a comprehensive plan, for a durable solution, a long-term solution for these people. And that includes they either get resettled to a third location, which again, we've seen some of, or they can integrate locally where they have been displaced to, or they return to their area of origin. So, you know, we've seen some of that, and the government gives them cash when they do that. So they get some money when they, you know, to support their integration. They get some money to support their return, and if they're resettled, then that's often into low income housing, you know, where they don't have a lot of rent to pay. So there is some support, yeah.
Well, and again, that's Lara Jacoby. She's Iraq Country Director for the International Rescue Committee and joining us from Baghdad, Iraq, which is why you're hearing probably some crackling sound on that phone line. But as you were saying, and as we learned during the height of the war, many Iraqis left their country, some going to Syria, some going to other neighboring countries. Now that there's conflict and fighting and civil war in Syria, are those Iraqi refugees coming back to Iraq?
Yeah, so that's what we're seeing is since last summer, actually, over 60,000 Iraqi refugees that went to Syria have now come back to Iraq. The challenge for them is, again, like many of the displaced, they cannot go back to their place, you know, their area of origin, their homes. So they're actually, a lot of them are joining the ranks of the million plus displaced people inside Iraq. So they're coming back, but they are by no means able to settle in a durable solution, find a permanent solution for themselves and their families inside Iraq.
And are you also seeing then Syrian refugees leaving Syria coming to Iraq, just to add to the complexity?
Yeah, exactly. Well, right. So, you know, Iraq is now, we have over 100,000 Syrian refugees that have come into Iraq. The majority of them are in northern Iraq, in the Kurdistan region, and there's a camp there for them. And then some of them are coming to central Iraq. Well, actually, they had come to central Iraq in the Anbar governorate, but now that border's closed. So they are no longer allowed to come into central Iraq, and they're only allowed to go up to the northern part of Iraq, to the Kurdistan region.
What are the conditions like in some of these either squatter camps or even in some of these looks like abandoned buildings or even some of these settlements? And we're talking about winter in Iraq.
Yeah, so you know, right. Again, there's in the settlements for the displaced people, there's very few services, and the biggest issue is, of course, the septic, and they're not connected to the sewage system, the city sewage system. So that's a big issue, and electricity as well. Of course, you know, electricity is very limited in all of Baghdad, and if you can't afford a generator, then you probably only have, you know, maybe 2 hours of electricity many days in the winter, so you have no heat, and then in the summer you have no way of cooling. Now for the Syrian refugees, a lot of them are of course in tents, and that was really brutal over the winter. During the rainy season, the tents weren't always waterproof, and there's a lot of overcrowding, so we've got multiple families trying to live in one tent with the source of heat might be a gas stove, which is dangerous. And a lot of them actually, the thing is the Syrians are coming in faster than the aid agencies or the government can support them. So they're just coming in, and a lot of them are sleeping out actually, without even a tent, when they first arrive, because, they're coming into Iraq at about, currently about 900 persons a day. And we just haven't been able to keep up with the need. Part of that is, the funding situation. There's been appeals to the international community, to donors for funding to respond to the Syrian refugees. But those are in Iraq. That's sure. only been met sure. about 50%. And of course, yeah.
Well, Laura Jacoby, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. It's very important to understand the condition for Iraqi refugees and, as you described, Syrians coming into Iraq, escaping the conflict in that neighboring country. Laura, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. That's Laura Jacoby, Iraq Country Director for the International Rescue Committee. Well, 10 years ago, the war in Iraq began with the bombing of Baghdad. More than 4,000 U.S. troops died during that war, and tens of thousands were wounded. Some lost limbs and are working to recover from serious injuries, while others are dealing with some of the psychological aftermath or effects of warfare. Joining us now is Paul Rykoff. He's Executive Director and Founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. He was a 1st Lieutenant Infantry Rifle Platoon Leader in Iraq from 2003 to 2004, wrote a book called Chasing Ghosts. And Paul Rykoff, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, ma'am.
Nice to have you with us as well. And to our listeners, we're talking about the legacy of the Iraq War. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Paul, what are your thoughts today as we mark this 10th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War?
Well, for me, like I think many Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, it's very personal. It's not just a news story. We think about the time we spent in Iraq. We think about the friends we've lost. We think about the sacrifices that our families have made. And it can be frustrating because you turn on the TV or you listen to the radio and you feel like you see a bunch of policy wonks talking about a few years of your life. But I think what we're really focused on this week as an organization, as a nonprofit organization supporting veterans, is making sure we think about what happens now.
Right.
What happens for the 2.3 million men and women who served in Iraq and Afghanistan? And specifically, we're focused on Washington and trying to end the backlog that exists at the VA, which I hope we can get into. But we've got dozens of veterans from around the country who are in Washington right now on Capitol Hill, advocating for themselves and for their brothers and sisters on issues like the VA backlog, veteran suicide, unemployment, and women's care. We hope that this week can be an opportunity to refocus everyone, not just on the war, but on the warriors.
And I do want to get to all of that, all that you just laid out there. But you mentioned the fact that you hear, as we all do, policy wonks talking about the Iraq war. This is a broad-based question, but what don't they understand as you hear them talk?
Well, you know, I was on a show earlier today, and they talked a lot about the run-up to the war and who did what and the finger-pointing in Washington, and I think that's an important conversation to have. You know, how did it happen? How did it go down? But it seems to be we're relitigating it over and over again, and we're ignoring the elephant in the room, which is that right now almost a million veterans are waiting for care. That's a new story. That number will reach a million by the end of March 2013. Veterans are waiting for benefits right now across the country, across Philly, across Jersey. The average wait time for a veteran coming home and filing for disability is about 320 days. So, you know, it feels like a disconnected conversation. We're talking a lot about the communities in Iraq, and we should, but I think we're forgetting to talk about the communities here in America where these veterans have come home, and too many of them and their families are struggling.
Well, in fact, you're referencing a piece done for the Center for Investigative Reporting. They got their hands on some Veterans Affairs documents. They did some interviews, getting those documents through the Freedom of Information Act, and as you said, finding that there are increased delays for benefits, and I believe in cities the size of New York, that delay can be as much as 642 days, which is almost 2 years of delay.
Yeah, this is a blockbuster report, and I appreciate you covering it because it didn't get a lot of national coverage. What we found in this shocking report is that the number of veterans that are waiting has grown by 2,000% since President Obama took office, from 10,000 in January of 2009 to 243,000 as of December 2012. So that means that thousands of veterans are staring at their mailbox or watching their email or making phone calls to find out when they're going to get the care and benefits they need. And these rates are much higher than the VA had originally told us. So, for example, in New York, it's 642 days. In Los Angeles, it's 619. In Chicago, 542 days. In Reno, Nevada, 681 days. So it's nationwide. And there's a massive breakdown here. Despite the fact that it's 2013, 97% of these claims are still on paper. So all week long, we're focused on Congress and we're focused on the president to tell him, look, you've ended the Iraq war, and everybody seems happy about that, but now let's end the backlog. If we can end two wars, we should be able to end a broken bureaucratic system that's putting our veterans in tremendous jeopardy.
And about a minute before our break that's coming up, but just picking up on what you just said, and this is from Aaron Glantz, who wrote the piece for the Center for Investigative Reporting, finding, as you said, that the VA spent hundreds of millions of dollars on a computer system, but most of the claims are filed on paper, and there's so much paper that it's even stretching and compromising the integrity of a building that's housing some of that paper.
Yeah, there's a building in Winston-Salem that has been basically shut down because it's a health hazard, because there's so much paper piled up, they're worried the building's going to collapse. That shows you where things are, and I would encourage folks to check out our website while we're having this conversation. Go to IAVA.org. You can learn more about these issues. You can download all the information, and you can see the faces behind these numbers, which we think is really the most important part.
Well, let's take that very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Paul Rykoff. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are marking the 10th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. And Paul Rykoff is Executive Director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. And he served in Iraq and joins us on Radio Times. Any questions or comments? We want to know what you make of the legacy of the Iraq War and some of the challenges facing veterans. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Arcadia University's Summer Sessions supports WHYY. Summer sessions at Arcadia are designed to keep you ahead of your degree studies, enhance your professional knowledge, or introduce you to new topics. Online classroom and blended course options offered in accelerated formats in many disciplines at Arcadia's Glenside or King of Prussia campus. Registration is open now. Session 1 starts May 20th. Information and registration at arcadia.edu/summer now.
On the next Fresh Air, on the 10th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War, we talk with Aaron Glantz of the Center for Investigative Reporting. He arrived in Iraq just after Saddam Hussein fell, but for the past few years, he's been covering the lives of American veterans and investigating why many of them face lengthy delays in receiving disability benefits from the VA. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Retired Army Colonel and Iraq War critic Andrew Basevich has some thoughts on the 10th anniversary of the start of the war. We'll hear them. Also, President Obama off to Israel this week. What does he need to achieve on his first ever presidential visit to that country? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Paul Rykoff. He is Executive Director and Founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. And yes, today marks the 10th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. And he's the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. And we want to hear from you. Have you forgotten about this war? What are the lessons of this war? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Paul, getting to this backlog at the VA, what should be done about it? What is going to move this forward? And I have to say, the VA says they are working on it, but does that give you any confidence?
No. They say they're working on it, but they've missed most of their major benchmarks. And they also, in 2009, stood up an electronic record-keeping system with the Department of Defense and spent $500 million on it and scrapped it a few weeks ago. So right now, it's clear that veterans can't count on the VA to do it themselves. And we want the VA to succeed, but the president's got to get involved. The president has got to make this a priority. So IVA is calling on him to get involved and end the VA backlog. We want to set up a presidential commission. We're asking all Americans to join us in doing that. So if you go to IAVA.org, you can sign that petition. We're actually going to bring it to the White House for a meeting tomorrow, and we're also going to have a rally on Capitol Hill. This has gone on long enough. It's just absolutely madness. Close to a million veterans should not wait for their care. And to localize it a bit for your audience, in Philly, that wait is 517 days. 517 days for your benefits. In Pittsburgh, it's 625. So this is real life for real people who are right now waiting for care. And another component of that story, almost 20,000 veterans died last year before their benefits were processed. So for some folks, this is literally a matter of life and death, and we need everybody behind it.
When you say you want the president to get involved, what do you want him to do?
Well, the presidential commission would be a good start. We had one after 9/11. We've had one after enormous issues that it seemed to vex a department or a specific agency. So we need the full force of the U.S. government and the entire country behind this. He can bring people in from the private sector. He can make the interagency collaboration that hasn't happened start to move forward. But he's got to make it a national priority. If he says he cares about our veterans and he wants to put his money where his mouth is, end the backlog. And not at the end of 2015. That's just ridiculous that the VA can stand up in Congress and say, okay, veterans, we're working on it, and it might be fixed by the end of 2015. The war started over 10 years ago. It shouldn't take us that long to fix a paperwork process. This is something that healthcare companies do, that a variety of other companies and agencies across America and across the globe have succeeded in doing. They've modernized. And we need a real kick in the butt here from the president to make it happen and deliver for our veterans.
What do you think Shinseki should do?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what else he can do. Maybe this is beyond him. I know that there are some pilot programs in the works. We'd like to hear from him personally and hear what he thinks about what's going on here. Tomorrow, Undersecretary of Veterans Affairs Hickey will testify, but as of now, the Secretary will not. So we need him to understand what our veterans are facing. These wait times are not acceptable. The plan ahead is not fast enough, and we need to know we can trust him. We need to know that he hears our calls and he hears what our families are facing and that he can do something about it because the wait is just too long.
Why a commission, though? And oftentimes commissions are organized. They come up with a report, and it doesn't necessarily mean that anything changes.
You know, it's just one focus for us. I mean, what it would show is presidential leadership, and that's really what we need here. I mean, we don't have all the solutions. And honestly, I don't think veterans should be responsible for coming up with them because part of the problem is they're asking us to diagnose the VA, and we're not inside. So it's like asking us what's wrong with a car when we can't lift up the hood. We just know that it's not running and it's not working, and our brothers and sisters in major cities are waiting 600 days. So I hope the president can stand up and enlist the brilliance of this country and everyone in it to focus on this and to deliver to our veterans and families. And if they really support us and support these communities, that's the best way to do it.
I do want to get to some of our callers at 1-888-477-9499. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. But Paul, let me just ask you, because I know early on in the war, a number of Marine soldiers were complaining that they didn't have enough body armor, that the, you know, that their trucks were not protected from IEDs, and now we're hearing about these long delays in getting benefits. What does that tell us about how we think about people who fight for us?
Well, history is repeating itself. You know, I was in one of those units in Baghdad in 2004 that didn't have adequate body armor. We didn't have vehicular armor, and we had folks wounded and killed that might have been saved if we had it. So it was clear when I got to Iraq that there wasn't a plan for the peace. And there's the old saying that, failing to plan is planning to fail. Well, we failed to plan adequately in Iraq, and ironically, we failed to plan again for the peace back home. So we haven't thought about how these folks are going to come home to local communities, and that's why we see an unacceptable unemployment rate. That's why we see a skyrocketing suicide rate, where we're losing about 22 veterans every day. We just didn't plan for the mental health counselors. We didn't plan for the paperwork processors. We didn't plan for the psychiatrists. In the same way, we didn't plan for interpreters and body armor in Iraq.
You had mentioned families, and I just wanted to want you to speak to that, and then we will get to our callers. The kind of families that veterans' families and the kinds of needs, I guess, and stresses that they're experiencing.
Well, Art Davis is one of the veterans who's here with me in Washington this week, and he served for about 18 years in the Navy. And he did four combat tours. And right now he's waiting for his children to be added to his disability claim. He got married. He has three stepchildren now. And he held a poster up on our Tumblr page. Folks can see these images if they go to IAVA.org. He held up a sign that said, "By the time my disability claim is approved," his son had another sign that said, "I'll have my driver's license." So this is impacting Art's children. This is impacting Art's wife. This is impacting his ability to have a job. And it's really overflowing into every community. So he's a guy who could be back at work. He could be a teacher. He could be contributing to a local small business. But instead, he's stuck in this bureaucratic limbo. And so is his family. So, you know, our family members are really the unsung heroes of this last decade of war. There have been about 2.5 million men and women who've served, but if you put their families in, it's over 10 million. So over 10 million Americans have sacrificed for a decade, and they really deserve this care.
Let me get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Gary from Lambertville. And Gary, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, yeah, Gary from Lambertville.
Yes, go ahead.
My hope is that the lesson learned from the war is that we were wiser in the future, and acknowledge the costs beyond just the immediate warfare, that it's a long-term recovery, probably half a century, mm-hmm. of required benefits and support for not only the combatants but the families and nation itself.
Well, Gary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Paul Rykoff, we've been, you know, trying to figure out what some of the lessons of this war might be. From your perspective, what have you taken away?
Well, I think personally and professionally, what has really been driven home to me is that when you send a country to war, the impact spans generations. It's not a reality TV show. It's not a video game. And right now, the Department of Veterans Affairs is still providing care to World War II veterans. The suicide numbers that we talked about, the average age of suicide was over 50. So that means those are Vietnam vets. And many of the folks that are stuck in the backlog right now are Vietnam vets. So I think it's time for America to fully appreciate the sacrifices and to really recognize that this is a solemn moral obligation. You may not agree with the war, but we've all got to take care of the warriors, and we've got to recognize that right now we've never really done it right. The Vietnam veterans came home to a ridiculous situation where they were confused with the war, and now we've finally separated the war from the warriors, but we're not across the goal line yet. Until they're doing well, they have the health care they deserve, they're graduating from school, and they're contributing members of societies and really leaders, until we see them emerging as that generation of leaders, our work is not done.
Gary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Paul, before we get back to our callers, and I want to ask this carefully, because we have done a number of shows some with you and some with others, talking about vets and returning soldiers and Marines from either Iraq or Afghanistan. And I remember several of them saying to me, you know, not everyone is suffering because of this war. Some of us are actually okay. And I think we rightly focus on those who are suffering the after effects. But I don't want us to think that that's experience for everybody that comes back from war.
No, it's a very important point. Not everyone comes home from war with an injury, but nobody comes home unchanged.
Right.
And many folks come back with experience and with a fortitude and a focus that they wouldn't have had if they hadn't gone overseas. And we do believe that they represent a generation of incredible leaders who can turn around our economy and who can create great innovations. And we look at them as not just your local security guard, but maybe the next Mark Zuckerberg. One good news story that's come out is that over 500,000 veterans have used the new post 9/11 GI Bill. They're graduating from Ivy League schools. They're graduating from community colleges and vocational schools all around the country. And they represent what we think can be a pragmatic, effective, innovative generation. They can be what we've called the innovation generation. And they can represent a tremendous new breath of fresh air, not just around the country, but especially in Washington, where it seems like nothing gets done and nobody can get along.
Where it might be nice to have someone that follows orders, you mean?
Well, not just that, but, you know, we've got a historic low of veterans in Congress, too. Right now there's only one Vietnam veteran, that's John McCain in the Senate, and only one World War II veteran in the Senate, and that's Frank Lauenberg from New Jersey. So we need, back in the day they would work together. They would cross partisan lines. And when the GI Bill was passed in 2008, Senator Warner was a Republican who worked with Senator Webb, who was a Democrat. They had both served overseas, and they had that commonality of experience to put country first ahead of party. We don't see a lot of that in this town right now.
But I also wonder about some of the skills that Marines, soldiers learn in war, that some of those can be translated to the civilian sector as well.
Absolutely. They're extremely entrepreneurial, and I think that's one thing that we want to focus on. They're not just robots. There's this idea that they only follow orders and they can only go in a straight line. But imagine a young 20-year-old private who's on a checkpoint in Afghanistan right now with tremendous pressure and limited guidance and limited resources. He's entrepreneurial. He's creating things and coming up with solutions every single day. And that spirit of entrepreneurship is what we've seen out of every generation of veterans, making do with less, and as we used to say in the infantry, adapting, improvise, and overcoming. That's what they did in Baghdad and Kabul, and that's now what they can do in New York and in Silicon Valley, and even in places of crisis, like in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina hit.
Let me see what Nancy from Drexel Hill has to say. Nancy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
My comment is, I know someone very well who is a professional who provides mental health services. He's now at the second VA. And they really, part of what's going on, I'm sure there are other things, but part of it is they do not begin to have enough staff. Mm. These people carry caseloads that are ridiculous, and I'm not saying it to get sympathy for them, but just to point out there's no way with the number of people they have that they are going to begin to scratch the surface of meeting the needs of those veterans who do very much need these services. And, you know, in my view, I mean, we can't just rail against the VA. If we care, we have to talk to our congressional representatives, and we can't rail against big government and then complain that, you know, we can't serve our veterans. So that's it.
No, it's a good point, Nancy. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Paul, you want to add to that?
I do. I think it's a very good point. Look, there are some incredible, heroic people working inside the VA. Every day they're trying to care for our veterans. But they are outgunned and overmatched, and they don't have the ammunition that they need to be successful. And we've got to empower them. But more importantly, I think to your caller's point, the VA is not the hub of the wheel. It's a spoke in the wheel. And the VA right now only serves about 54% of Iraq and Afghanistan vets. Some of them don't want the care. Some of them don't think they need the care. But a lot of others are going to community-based nonprofits. It could be a local veterans group. It could be a local church group. It could be the YMCA. So we've seen a tremendous overflow of the needs of these veterans that are impacting the private sector and specifically the nonprofit sector. So anyone listening that wants to make a difference, you can do something in your community. You can volunteer with a local group. You can give money. You can give time. But there is a need out there, whether it's mentoring a young vet who's coming home or hiring them. There's a lot that we can do at the local level instead of just waiting around for Washington to fix itself.
Let me get Ken from Phoenixville to join us. And Ken, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
In answer to the question as to why it takes so long, the VA had a bureaucratic system about doing claims that went back years and years. And one of the problems is, instead of them taking the whole system and getting rid of all those redundancies and double-checking, they put a computer system on top of an old-fashioned manual system, which has resulted in those delays. The other thing is regarding those dependency claims. I fought that for years to try to get people to add dependents, but the reason they don't let you do it is the management has priorities that the first claim in is the one that's done first.
Right.
And that makes everything like someone with a dependency claim, they may be way behind someone with a very complicated claim. Well, and I always said that they should have two lines, but they just never did it.
Well, Ken, I appreciate the call, and I should say it looks like he worked at the Philadelphia VA. Paul, anything? I heard you say right. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, think about this. If you filed your tax returns in the last couple of months, you probably got an electronic deposit back within a few weeks. A few weeks for your tax returns, but for Art Davis and other veterans coming home, they've got to wait 600 days. It just doesn't seem like a real problem we should be having in 2013. So, again, we hope folks will stand with us. Call on the president to get involved. Call on everyone you know in your local community to get involved. If you want something to do this anniversary of the Iraq War, help us end the backlog. Go to our website, sign the petition, IAVA.org, and we appreciate you supporting us and having our backs.
Ken, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Paul Rykoff, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for the time and the focus, ma'am.
You're welcome. And he's executive director, founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. He was a first lieutenant and infantry rifle platoon leader in Iraq from 2003 to 2004, wrote a book called Chasing Ghosts. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of the show, but stay with us. We'll be right back. Coming up next, music and conversation with mezzo-soprano Lori Rubin. She's written a memoir titled Do You Dream in Color? She also has a CD of the same name. That's coming up next here on Radio Times.